Okay, let's move into the open public input. A number of people who've signed up. Thanks. Okay, first, the rules. The commission has set a 3-minute limit on all public testimony. So we'd like you to, when I call your name, we'd like you to come forward, speak into the mic, but not too close. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up. So we'd like you to conclude your remarks. And if you don't hear the beeper, we try to make it loud enough so that it is unmistakable. But if you don't hear it, I'll then have to interrupt you and ask you to conclude. So the first person who signed up is Harold Brunstad. Would you come forward? You want to wait until?
He's just second, Miranda. They're just one and two.
Okay. Okay, and Ken Miller?
Three minutes is going to be a real challenge, so I'll have to skip a lot of stuff here. For the record, I'm Ken Miller. I've been here before. I won't get through the whole packet that you have there. The bulk of it is minutes or testimony that I gave in previous years is background information. And the third page, there's another photo I've shared with you every year for the last several years. This is a tree that was damaged badly last year, and the bears came back and finished it off this year by completely girdling it today. And that was a sow and a cub, and as far as I know, they're still out there doing about 50 trees a day. So in 3 minutes... I've been pretty optimistic, and I think collaborative and past testimony today is not the case. It just isn't working out. I got to kind of skim down through here. We had meetings at your request with the WDFW, and it took almost a year to get that meeting set up. It was a struggle. Since then, there have been no positive changes made in 2011, and this year, at the very last minute, without consultation, the department ratcheted up the requirements on us, even blatantly adding coercion to their list of irrational and unwarranted depredation permit requirements on landowners needing help, or at least reasonable cooperation. I won't go into it. Our personal relationship with Sean Carroll is very good. Everybody will say that. So this is not about personalities. But I want you to just imagine how you would feel if you had a critter destroying your once-in-a-lifetime crop and WDFW said you had to get a permit to protect your own product property. And if they reluctantly do give you a permit, you are now required to leave your private property, gates, and roads open to public access. Would city folks that want bears out of their backyards at this time of the year let the public into their backyards just as a condition for helping get the WDFW to get rid of their bears? Would the ag or ranching communities that get compensation programs, would they stand for this, what I call apparent arrogance? There are several other over-the-top permit requirements that are new that I won't go into that are itemized in my testimony. I'm not here to tell you that there are easy solutions to excessive bear damage. Hounds are not the only solution, but they are a critical option in our tool bag. Nor am I trying to ignore the staffing problems at WDFW. I am saying that WDFW, in its zeal to protect all wildlife, has lost sight of what should be a critical part of their vision for win-win ways to work collaboratively with landowners trying to protect their forests. Forests without wildlife would have less prime habitat. How does antagonizing ignoring and disrespecting the rights of private forest landowners serve the overall mission of WDFW and this commission. In closing, three real easy things that I'm asking the commission to do. Number one, when you see a news story about WDFW expending scarce resources by rightly coming to the rescue of some city or urban folks because of problem animals, would you please just ask yourselves, I wonder what WDFW is doing to help rural folks who are providing the needed habitat? Secondly, when you listen to this afternoon's report from WDFW about their Karelian bear dog program, ask, is this hound really any different in result? Are WDFW hounds or WDFW hunters the only good acceptable ones? And lastly, please instruct WDFW to report back to the commission before this year is over on the steps and agreements they have taken to help resolve the issues with forest landowners so we don't have a repeat of 2012. Thank you very much, and I'd be delighted to take any questions.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. You talk about reluctantly give you a permit. You're now required to leave your private property gates and roads open for public access. Could you just expound on that just a little?
It was a new part of the conditions. They say if we give you a depredation permit, now this just has with hound hunters. It's apparently not with the bait hunters or the snare hunters. It says that you have to leave your gates open from during the regular bear season, which is August 1st to I don't know, end of November or something.
Okay.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you tried things like alternate feeds and that sort of thing, and has that done any good?
I have tried feeding. I couldn't get them started the year I tried that, and then I got to looking at the expense. I only have 40-some acres. It was going to be $1,000 or more a year, plus I got to go up and tend it regularly. To their credit, WDFW has started what they call a master hunter program, which I did start last year. I had two bait hunters up on my property. They were unsuccessful, but I tried again this year, and they were successful in getting one bear about a month ago. It was a male bear. The bear that did the damage that I'm showing you was a sow and a cub. We can tell that by the claw marks. So, we're trying everything. If we did everything, which is what I'm trying to do, you're still partially successful. All you can do is just kind of keep running them out of the area. But
thank you.
It's a tough problem.
I'm going to call on Commissioner Smith, and then I have to inform the commission that we've got probably another 25 minutes of testimony ahead from the rest of the public, and this is an important issue, but I would refer it to the Wildlife Committee to discuss. Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. Yeah, just a quick note. The requirement for the landowner to maintain the carcass, the gallbladder, I appreciate while we don't want that to get on the illegal open market, but to have the burden fall on the landowner to maintain the hide and all of that, as you say, that doesn't seem like a long-term workable solution unless each landowner has adequate storage capacity to do that. So
it simply reflects the distrust of the hunter, and they're pushing that burden onto the landowner.
Okay. Commissioner Mencken.
Sorry, Raleigh. Mr. Miller has appeared before us a number of times, and he's been mostly decent in his testimony. He asks for assistance from the department, and he's clearly not getting it in a timely fashion. I, for one, would like very much to see his needs serviced in a timely fashion and the department rise to the occasion. Here, as a commissioner, I am very dissatisfied with the way that we've treated Mr. Miller on these issues.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Chair, I think Commissioner Mencken spoke for me, but your solution is a good one. for those of us on the Wildlife Committee to get our hands on this, to deal directly with their needs. I assume that also means that we can hear the rest of the testimony, because I agree with Commissioner Macon.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mullen.
Thank you very much.
Richard Atkin.
I wanted to mention, you also have in your packet a letter from Steve Stinson, or Steve Peterson, that talks to this issue and makes some additional points. So, thank you.
Okay. Richard Atkins.
Good morning. My name is Richard Atkins. Together with my wife and three grown children, we own an 875-acre tree farm in Grays Harbor County. Like many farmers, we plant our crop, thin and weed, and harvest when it is financially mature, in our case at about 40 to 45 years of age. We are members of Washington Farm Bureau and think of ourselves as farmers. Where we differ from agricultural farmers is in the treatment under the laws and rules of the state. 20% of the crop we have planted, thinned, and managed on this tree farm has been permanently set aside under the forests and fish law and rules for the exclusive use of wildlife, fish and wildlife. It can never be harvested. Has any agricultural farm, or any other business for that matter, been required to give up this amount of their land or production without compensation? The 80% we have left for timber production also provides good habitat for birds and other animals, small and large. Black bear in particular find our property to be very good habitat. One of their favorite foods this time of year is a new growth of sapling found just under the bark of Douglas fir, cedar, and hemlock, 10 to 30-year-old trees. After documenting the damage amounting to over $10,000 in some years, we received predation permits for hound hunting during the damaged season of mid-April to early July for every year from 2006 through 2011. A total of 5 bears were killed in those 6 years. Damage continued to occur every year before, after, and between hunts and by other bears moving in. I'm sure the predation hunts reduced the damage by scaring off some bears and killing some, but the bear population is so large that damage cannot be eliminated. There were some communication problems between me, WDFW, and hunters in the first couple of years of predation permits, but these were gradually worked out. When a bear was killed, the hunters took a tooth and the gallbladder to WDFW Montesano office and the carcass to Patriotic Packing in Raymond. The animal was butchered there with the meat delivered to Union Gospel Mission in Aberdeen and the hide to Centralia Hide Company. Patriotic Packing sent me receipts received from all parties involved, along with their bill for $150 per bear. I sent a report to WDFW along with the receipts. The system seemed to be working to everyone's satisfaction, except for some delays and a lot of paperwork. Before the 2011 damage season, some small forest landowners met with WDFW people at our request to see if the process could be further improved. Rather than renewing permits every 15 days with the problem, well, I just can't do it. Do you want to hear this or not?
Well, we have your testimony.
Okay, well.
And we've had a good...
It's very short.
Well, it's... we do have the testimony, and we've got quite a few people. And I apologize, but we do have a three-minute rule. I wasn't as firm as I should have been with Mr. Miller, but we do try to keep it to 3 minutes, and then the commission has an opportunity to ask questions. But we're interested in helping make sure that this problem is solved. So the Wildlife Committee is going to be on it and helpful, and we've got your testimony. So thanks very much. Okay, we have... I think several people from CCA who want to come up as a group. Ed Wickersham, Brian Walter, and Lyle Cabe. Is that right?
Madam Chair.
Over. Oh, Director Anderson.
Just before we change topics here, I listened intently to the testimony provided by Mr. Miller and Mr. Atkins.
I'm not going to wait for the Wildlife Committees to meet on this issue. I will get on this and get with our regional folks and find out. I want to make sure I know all the facts first as to what we've done and what we haven't done and where we can improve. But you have my commitment that I'm going to get on this issue, and I'll report back to you.
Great.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's great. And also, you know, looking at the comments from Richard Atkins, it does seem from a governor's lien perspective, you know, once ongoing damage has been documented, to have a permit that lasts for that 2 to 3 month period, this seems pretty efficient. And I can see the concern of opening up private lands to the public to allow public access as a cost for the depredation hunt. So I think we've heard some really good points here about the changes that happened in 2011 for you to look at.
The permit, the statutes that cover permits are extremely onerous to us as well, because we're limited by statute in terms of the duration. It's not in WAC, it's in statute about how often the permits need to be renewed. And Joe and I sign permits from everything from bear depredation pieces to beavers to you name it, constantly because of that statutory.
So maybe that's something we look forward in proposed legislation in the future to give us more flexibility.
I think it still would be productive for the Wildlife Committee to talk about the issue and appreciate the offer.
Sure, I'll report back to them.
Okay. So this will get on the agenda for the Wildlife Committee. Great. Okay. Turning to the Columbia River, you all each have 3 minutes. Just because you're up as a group doesn't mean you have any extra time. So we'll start with Ed Wickersham.
Good morning. I'm Ed Wickersham, a volunteer advocate speaking on behalf of CCA Washington. I would like you to know that my goal is to do what I can to help restore our fisheries resources for the good of us all. I gain no financial benefits from my efforts. As you know, CCA has been very concerned with the continuation of gill netting in the lower Columbia River. We are encouraged with the department's testing of selective commercial gear and view it as a positive move, but only if it does not further hamper recreational fisheries. And I would remind you, it is only being tested for fall Chinook and coho, so it does nothing for 10 of the 13 runs of ESA-listed fish that pass through in spring and summer. Furthermore, those spring and summer commercial fisheries are essentially unselective and contribute only about 8% of total commercial landings. Conversely, the Columbia River provides 37% of all recreationally caught salmon in Washington. We would suggest that setting a recreational priority for lower Columbia River non-tribal fisheries is needed and is supported by any perspective from which you wish to look at it. Recreational gear poses far less risk to wild fish and bycatch than gill nets. We now fish spring, summer, Chinook, coho, and steelhead selectively. The only nominally selective fishery with gill nets is in the spring, and those tangle nets still have substantially more mortality rate than recreational gear. Regardless, the tangle net fisheries are only able to be used in the spring, therefore 95% of all commercial fishing in the lower Columbia River is unselective. Presently, the department receives about 66% of its budget from the sportsmen, less than 14% from the general fund. There is little likelihood that general fund revenues are going to increase, so the health of the department rests with the recreational public. And one way to ensure increased revenue for the agency is to increase real fishing opportunity for the recreational sector. I am a member of the Columbia River Endorsement Board. Endorsement sales have been consistently at or above 220,000. Compare that to 255 gillnet licenses, of which about half are active. The Columbia River endorsements alone actually provide more revenue than the entire value of the lower Columbia River commercial fishery. Another major consideration is enhancing east side fisheries. I will tell you, the endorsement board is authorizing large expenditures to maintain and enhance east side fisheries. There's a significant opportunity on the east side. Unfortunately, because of the meager recreational allocation for spring Chinook, this last year, the area above Bonneville got 3 days of essentially 3 days of fishing above Bonneville for spring Chinook. One of the statements you hear from the gillnet crowd is that Washington Food Fish Policy is a mandate to continue their fishery. The policy states the department must maintain the economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry in the state. We agree with that policy and would respectfully point out that on the Columbia River there is a very robust tribal fishery, tribal commercial fishery. And recently the department argued in court, recently argued in court that the recreational sector is an industry in defending the move to place a priority for recreational crabbing in Puget Sound. The court agreed and upheld the department's position and the new policy that places a recreational priority on Puget Sound crab harvest. We would suggest that's an excellent example for the Columbia River. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Waller?
Okay. So my name is Brian Walter. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders and our thousands of members in Oregon and Washington. I'm actually also a board member like Ed on the Columbia River Endorsement Board, funding numerous projects for the department. I feel that department, that project has been very, very successful. But like Ed said, today a recreational priority now stands for Puget Sound crabs and Chinook salmon based on substantial economic, social, and conservation concerns and is supported by existing law. The next essential and logical step is for Washington to move towards a recreational priority for Columbia River salmon fisheries, particularly spring and summer Chinook. While the shift would affect only a small fraction of our state's commercial fisheries, it would provide enormous conservation and economic benefits. In fact, all of the same social equity and economic concerns supporting recreational priority for Puget Sound crabs also support the recreational priority for Columbia River salmon, with one major addition. And that is, in the case of crabbing, at least commercial gear could be employed selectively to control the harvest. Not so with gillnets. The gillnet is woefully inappropriate for the mixed stock fisheries of the Columbia River and count as yet another reason to keep this fishery off of the main stem. The nets are now employed to fish on the top 13 species of salmon and steelhead listed under the ESA, as well as a white sturgeon population that appears to be headed for collapse. The 2012 spring Chinook fishery offers an excellent example of the economic contribution to the recreational angler is willing to make just for the opportunity to catch a salmon. Providing opportunity is paramount to fueling the economic engine of recreational angling. On average, a recreational angler fishes for 8.73 days to catch one spring Chinook. And I can tell you the first 3 weeks of this season was a lot longer. According to the Washington State's own economic study, they contribute an average of $65.61 per day in economic value. This calculates to $572 per harvested fish. For the 2012 Columbia River spring Chinook season, the commercial fishery is being allocated 13,000 fish out of the main stem and are expected to catch an additional 10,600 in the safe areas. Moving these 13,000 gillnet-bound fish to the recreational sector would generate $7.44 million in economic value, almost three times the value of all Washington's non-tribal commercial salmon landings statewide. These 13,000 fish are a very small portion of Washington's commercial salmon landings and a tiny fraction of overall commercial fisheries, but could make a huge impact if they were caught by sport fishers. And I'd like to say, you know, getting back to the endorsement board, you know, there's 220,000 some odd endorsements sold per year. It generates about $1.8 million in revenue for the department's projects a year. I do believe creating meaningful opportunity for sport fishermen could easily double that number. And just imagine if, you know, 15 to 30% didn't go to indirect.
Thank you. Commissioner Duvia?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian, be interested in your thoughts on the summer run impact on the gillnetters on the steelhead.
You know, a gillnet, if you take and you measure it, it's very small, and I would just bet a lot of money you can't fit a steelhead through there. And summer steelhead are, you know, massively a concern of everybody. I partake myself in the recreational summer steelhead fishery on the Columbia a lot, and I place a very high value on that fishery. I think the summer fisheries are the single biggest opportunity to increase revenues for the endorsement board as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Cape.
Chair, commissioners, good morning. My name is Lyle Cabe, and I'm also a volunteer with the CCA Washington. I'd like to make two primary points. First, the safe area production has grown to a point where the supply can meet public's need for the spring Chinook. Secondly, main stem non-selective netting eats into the non-tribal ESA allocation quickly, which greatly constrains what could be a world-class fishery with great economic benefits to the state of Washington. There's simply not enough spring Chinook in the to support both a robust recreational fishery and a non-selective commercial fishery in the main stem Columbia. Safe areas were developed where hatchery-produced salmon are raised in upriver hatcheries, then transferred to safe areas in the lower river. While this reduces the number of fish available to the recreational sector, it allows for a selective net fishery off the main stem with minimal impacts to naturally produced fish. The majority of spring salmon angling now occurs in March, where for the first 3 weeks, anglers fish an average of 37 days for each fish caught. If the sport fleet were able to fish during the peak of the spring season, the economic benefit would greatly increase. The off-channel safe areas are fished from February through June and produce roughly 70% of the entire gillnet harvest of spring Chinook. There's no reason to continue gillnetting on the main stem during the spring season, where a very minor additional catch of hatchery fish can seriously damage wild fish and greatly constrain recreational opportunities. Harvest opportunities are based on run size. With a smaller run, the recreational fishery share is higher because of its ability to selectively harvest a high number of hatchery fish for each wild fish killed. A catch balancing agreement is in effect with treaty tribes, and it reduces fish available to recreational fisheries. This year, a run size of over 300,000 was forecast. The non-tribal ESA limit was 22,000 fish. Due to the commercial allocation and catch balancing, the recreational catch was capped 6,000 fish under the ESA limit. This equates to many lost days fishing and a huge missed opportunity for economics to money for the state of Washington. The solution to these concerns is straightforward. Establish a recreational priority for spring and summer Chinook. Removing gillnets from the main stem from January to July would reduce the total main stem commercial salmon landings by only 8%. The conservation benefits of a recreational priority is clear. Minimal ESA impacts. The economic benefit of more than 200,000 Washingtonians fishing the Columbia spring season is also clear. Sport fishing provides 17 times more economic benefit. And in wrap-up, this isn't about an allocation battle. This is about stewardship of fragile ESA-listed fish and greatly increasing the economic benefit to the state of Washington. Thank you for your attention, and could we take any questions from you?
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is for my clarification. I'm not certain of this, and maybe that you or the director can help me. On our impact allocation, we basically, in the safe areas, don't have any impact of significance that affects that. Does the catch in the safe areas impact catch balancing?
It's considered aside from the main stem. They do, the department does provide, and somebody can correct me, 0.2 of a percent of impact or 0.1 impact. They typically don't use them, but it doesn't go towards catch balancing. Catch balancing is about main stem upriver fish. Does that answer your question, Commissioner?
And the ESA impacts in the safe area are well less than 5%. And like Ed said, normally around 2%.
Okay,
tenths.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bob Schlecht.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Bob Schlecht. I own Bob's Sporting Goods in Longview, Washington. My father opened Bob's in 1947 And he's kind of the epitome of the American dream. He rode the rail car out to Longview and fell in love with the Columbia River Basin. And other than going in the Navy for World War II, he never left. At age 91, he still comes into the store every day, which is a real joy for us. I took Bob's over 35 short years ago. My son Matt is in the process of taking it over from me as I near retirement. His son Brady or his daughter Brooklyn are going to have to hopefully wait for their turn, and they'll get their turn. Bob's is a full-line outdoor store, but our forte is fishing. And the premier fishing in our area is Columbia River Chinook. That's the big one. We estimate that about 40% of our over $10 million annual volume is directly attributable to fishing. We've had a lot of changes over the last 65 years, but one of the constants has been that we've been on the banks of the Columbia River. I can honestly say that as goes the Columbia, so goes the fate of Bob's, and as the fate of Bob's goes the fate of the 60-plus families that we employ. We pay family wages with full medical benefits and support many local and regional manufacturers like Jensen, Lamb Glass, and lots of others. The last I heard outside of the internet, Bob's is the largest single sale of game license, single location for game licenses. I'm not sure that's the good news or the bad news for us. I'm not here to berate any of the other stakeholders on the Columbia River. Many are friends, neighbors, relatives, and customers. But I am here as living proof of the economic value of the sport fishing industry in my area. Small policy changes can have a big effect this fall and help ensure that Bob's and hundreds of other small businesses that depend on sport fishing can survive and thrive. Our vitality means more employment, more taxes, more game licenses, more involvement in our community, more dollars spent with Washington companies. I believe that the multiplier effect on the dollar spent on fishing tackle is vastly underestimated. And in closing, my accountant says that if I invite you guys to come shopping at Bob's, I can write this trip off, so you're all invited. Again, thanks for the consideration. But someday, during Chinook fishing on the Columbia, stop by Bob's or another store on the Columbia, and then stop by that same store when it's not open. It's amazing. You know, go through Kalama and see not a vacancy at the hotels and the boat launches jammed the same day without the Columbia River open. Terrible. So thank you for your consideration. Any questions?
Yeah, we have one. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a recommendation or a group of recommendations?
Probably the one I'd leave you with would be as the inevitability of, say, the fall season when it is going to close, that we look at select fishing to keep the river open. Some of the statistics that the gentleman mentioned are awesome. Just for the chance of catching a fish, a lot of people come into our area, spend money, they stay in hotels. They really is a boost to the economy. And allowing, again, the potential to catch a fish. If the river is just flat out closed, it's shut down. Select makes a big difference.
Can I ask you a question that you may or may not want to answer? How much sales tax does your company contribute to the state per year?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I would say because we're right on the border of Oregon, so we have a significant, like 15% of our business goes to Oregon, but on, say, I would say $600,000? Yeah, something like 6% of our volume probably goes on sales tax.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Bob, thanks for bringing your thoughts to us today. How important, if we extend the season through Labor Day, would it be for your store? If we went to selecting fishing?
Close the river but go select fishing. Is that your question?
More or less, yeah. And a lot of times we close before Labor Day.
Yeah, it's ex- extraordinarily important. And not only is it important, but it's important to let people know that we're going to do that. Because a lot of folks come into our area, plan vacations. I feel sorry for the guides when they really don't know, you know, what the season is going to be. So predictability would be important. But, yeah, Labor Day is just key core. You know, it's very important. The folks down at the beach and all the way up and down the river, it's just, you know, it's a huge time for them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dan Grogan.
Good morning. I'm Dan Grogan. I'm the president and owner of Fisherman's Marine and Outdoor. We employ 140 people. We've been in business for 38 years. 40 of those people come from Southwest Washington. Our stores are in North Portland, Tigard, Oregon City, two locations in North Portland. The main issue, I'm here to talk about climber issues and how they affect my business. The main issue is that we have an extremely limited resource. We have two fisheries on it. We have a commercial fishery and we have a recreational fishery. With the minimum resource and splitting that, it's become unmeaningful for either fishery. And with a move to increase releases in the select areas, it's given much more catch to the commercials. And I think that that's where you need to move to increase the commercial fisheries and move them off the main stem so that the recreationals can have a meaningful fishery. That's where the recreational access is. As far as commercial fisheries go, you have an ocean commercial fishery, you have the select area commercial fisheries, you have the tribal commercial fisheries. In the ocean's case, it's over 90-some%. How it affects my business from one day to the next, I went back and looked over the past 3 years. On average, from one day to the very next of the river closing, our sales dropped 41%. So obviously, it's very meaningful. We go to the sportsman show. We rarely have a season to tell people whether we're open or not, whether the guides can book a trip or not. What do we buy for that season? You know, I can't buy this stuff 30 days in advance. I've got to buy stuff so the manufacturers can manufacture it and we can get it. Makes it extremely difficult to run any business that's trying to advertise it. The other thing that I see is that we continually, and have for, I've been in this business for 38 years, so the whole time I've been in it, but lately especially, we're just exporting our tourism. We're sending people to Canada and Alaska. If you open any outdoor magazine, that's almost all, you know, my vision of what could happen, hopefully, in my lifetime, is you can have 8 straight months of fishing on the Columbia River. You can have bed and breakfasts. You can have just like you do in Alaska with guides on them. And I think it's all doable, and I think it's reasonable, and I think that the commercial fishermen in the select areas, if we build those up, we're not getting rid of the guys, you know, and we're trying to build up their take, which we have done successfully, very successfully. And, you know, those are commission decisions that have moved those fish. So, and as you move those fish, it takes our fisheries. It doesn't help our fisheries. So, anyway, thank you very much for the chance.
Thanks. Good timing. Bob McCoy.
Good morning. I'm Bob McCoy, Mountain Lion Foundation from Sammamish, Washington. Today I'm speaking in support of the department's Karelian Bear Dog Program. Donations fund this innovative program, and the program has broad support in the community. The conservation community appreciates the department's effort in non-lethal management, and hunting organizations such as Safari Club International, Hunters Education have been generous with support for the program. I ask the Commission to encourage the Department to expand the program to all 6 regions and to train and equip all officers for immobilization. The KBDs have proven their worth since the late Rocky Spencer introduced Mishka into the field, and I believe that Enforcement Chief Bjork and Captain Huebner were not only right to support and expand the use of dogs in conflict management, but they showed astute political sensitivity. As an example, the department's 2008 attitude survey shows that 87% of Washington residents disagree that authorities should kill a cougar that wanders into town. The KBD program appeals to these residents while keeping them safe. Governor Gregoire saw the worth of the program when she awarded Captain Huebner a governor's award for leadership and management. The citation included, "With the belief that bears and humans can coexist, Captain Bill Huebner initiated a public education and information campaign. He worked with his staff and local media to successfully explain the problems of feeding wildlife and the value of reconditioning offending animals rather than destroying them." This year, Captain Huebner received the National Guy Bradley Lifetime Achievement Award. Captain Huebner's nomination letter included his role in establishing and managing the KBD program. "I am aware that reconditioning is more expensive than a bullet in the short run. However, as the department's website notes, over $1.7 billion is spent annually in Washington on wildlife watching activities, mostly in rural areas. Wildlife watching activities support more than 21,000 jobs, making it second only to Boeing and five times larger than Microsoft's employment. Wildlife watching yields $427 million in job income and generates $57 million in state tax revenues each year. The state's reputation as an ethical wildlife custodian appeals to non-consumptive users. Support of the KBD program enhances this reputation as groups such as Mountain Lion Foundation, Grizzly Bear Outreach Project, and Humane Society US, and local and national media feature articles and news releases on our KBDs. This afternoon you will hear about the program. I hope the commission will support the efforts of the department to maintain the safety of all our residents, both human and wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll take questions if anyone had one.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that presentation. Okay, Liz Hamilton.
As promised. And some of you don't need this. This is for those who are unfamiliar with the organization. It's just some packets about who we are. Good morning, Chair Wecker, members of the Commission, Director Anderson. My name is Liz Hamilton, and I've had the honor of serving as the Executive Director of Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association since its inception in 1993. We have over 300 members today, and we're like any industry. There's a food chain. We've got the manufacturing, the wholesale, the distribution. And then there's the tourism side of our industry, the guides, the charters, the marinas, the hotels. So, as you saw in your presentation yesterday, pretty much sport fishing industry is anywhere there's water, anywhere there's fish. In Washington, sport fishing employs over 14,000 people, and we generate over $1 billion in retail sales. This is according to a federal survey. I was really surprised by the presentation that over 200,000 Washingtonians purchase a license, an extra stamp to fish in the Columbia, because what that tells you is over a third of the license buying public are fishing in that river. That surprised me because it's below the Mason-Dixon line here in Olympia. So anyway, people do travel for that state. And for our industry, the spring Chinook fishery is really the one that tees things up for the year. It's the first salmon fishery of the year. We're so excited that in February we're buying gear, we're packing our boat trailer bearings, we're getting our motors checked out. This is the one that really sets the table for the rest of the year and the success. And you can tell that because it also generates between 100 and 200,000 angler trips just in about 4 to 6 weeks. And that's below Bonneville. I don't have the numbers for the whole thing. So your staff, Director Anderson, yesterday gave a really excellent presentation. And I know for most of you it must have been like drinking out of the fire hose, but it was very well done. But there were two things that really jumped out at me from the presentation. First, there just aren't enough fish to go around. You've got fisheries that started in El Waco and went all the way up the Snake, where the description of the frustration because of the demand, the unmet demand for the product, is just not happening. The other thing they did was give a great job of the snapshot of what the economics are to these fisheries. Again, they sprinkle money all the way up the river. And a lot of that is just because, crazy as we are, we get all excited to spend 8 days to catch one spring Chinook and take it home. I don't know why it is, but I have the disease too, or the birth defect, or whatever it is, I've got it. We had a study done by Southwick and Associates. They're the same people who do that federal survey I quoted earlier. They looked at spring Chinook and hindcasted if you had allocated the catch balance share to the sports, there would be a 40% increase in sales, licenses, economics, just from that 6 weeks of fisheries we talked about. So I will close by reminding you that the matrix is irrelevant and outdated today, and it is for three reasons. One, catch balancing. Second, the ongoing transfer of smolts out of tributaries into the safe areas. And third, that when you look at the fee increases, the capital budget increases, the extra tags and the excise tax that our industry pays, you got a lot of people who are frustrated because they feel like they're paying not to play. So we've got a problem. It begs some attention from the commission, and we're very grateful that you're looking at these issues. And again, Director, it was a great presentation yesterday by the staff.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. That concludes the open public. Oh, I'm sorry. We had someone who wanted. Mr. Brunstad, you want to come up now? You want to be the wrap-up batter here?
Probably we can pass over. My name is Harold Brunstad. I'm a small landowner on Grace Harbor. First of all, I'd like to thank the commission members for hearing our concerns. And this is concerns our forest-related bear damage and depredation permits. Secondly, I'd like to thank Ken Miller for taking the lead on behalf of small forest landowners in addressing bear damage concerns and depredation permitting process for several years. I can shorten my statement by concurring 100% with the concerns and views reflected in Mr. Miller's testimony. Particularly concerning are the increasingly onerous requirements that have been placed on landowners in order to acquire and execute a depredation permit for the past 2 years. Because of these impositions, I went to live snaring last year to address my bear depredation problem. It was effective in addressing the bear population, but I still suffered considerable damage. The problem with snaring, it is expensive, and the availability of individuals certified to use snares is totally inadequate to address the level of a bear damage problem. Additionally, in view of the fact that many small landowners experience bear damage, are retired, and the cost of snaring is economically prohibitive. For small landowners, the use of hounds is probably the most effective tool to prevent bear damage as long as it occurs on an aggressive frequency based on my own personal experience. Mr. Miller noted in his testimony the concern of WDFW culture clearly biased against hound hunters. That bias is a lot deeper than hound hunting, and it exists throughout many federal and state resource agencies. I do not take lightly making that statement in recognition and respect for the many public employees who do not fall into that culture mold and do an outstanding job in serving the public. I base my assessment on 43 years of personally participating in many resource issues, 37 years in public forums, including 16 years as a member of the State Forest Practices Board. I am proud of my years of service on the board supporting and implementing forest management practices that represent the highest standards in the nation. During those 16 years, I also observed the developing culture that we speak of. The direction and intensity of that culture has been increasing the 16 years subsequent to my service on the board. As a public agency, I believe the commission has a responsibility to be concerned of that culture and to help us deal with it. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've heard you loud and clear. Thanks
Any
very
questions?
Much for coming in. So Wildlife Committee, we need to take a break. We're about half an hour late now in our agenda, but Commissioner.
Madam Chair, would it be appropriate if I ask Bob one question before we break?
Bob McCoy?
I don't know his last name, the blue shirt? Bob.
Oh.
Is that appropriate, Madam Chair? Thank you.
Why don't you come forward?
Bob, I've heard different stories from different people in the tackle industry, and I'd like, for my clarification at least, explain to me, I know how my industry works, but explain to me the forecasting and purchasing, how it works in your industry, how far in advance you have to plan and strategize for 9, 10, 12 months from now, because I've heard things and I want to know what the facts are.
We do, you know, a fair amount of our purchasing is at need. You know, it's right in the season, but the bulk of our purchasing happens on a six-month window. Those are the commitments that the manufacturers need to build the product, and we're obviously in an environment where people aren't buying a lot of stuff to put on their shelves and hope retailers are going to come in and buy it. So they want firm commitments, and we have to give them those firm commitments. We get the best price. Then when we get in season, we have to make our adjustments. So there's a fairly long window.
Oh, okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
And the question obviously you're asking is, we in September, August and September, we're really searching our conscience. Now, how far out, what is a spring Chinook run? What are they going to do with a spring Chinook run? And it's a real head-scratcher every time. We would just love to have more certainty. It would make a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I